CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. From the surface of the planet Earth, we're looking at the sunspots on our very important star with Bob Zimmerman, who watches the sun very carefully for us once a month. There are predictions of the solar maximum, and there is so far a tracking that is interesting, telling us that the solar maximum is coming, but perhaps more, what do you say, Bob, hotter, unusual? How do you explain?
More activity, more sunspots. It's not necessary. There are indications that if there are a lot of sunspots, the sun produces a little bit more heat and light, and therefore it warms our climate. This is not totally confirmed, but there are strong hints of that, circumstantial and direct. But what's been happening over the last two, the last solar maximum back in 14 was very weak. And the predictions from the NOAA's panel of solar scientists, which they consider to be the consensus of the entire solar science community, was that the upcoming, the next maximum in 25 was going to also be weak and comparable to the one that just passed. And since each month I track and post on Behind the Black a graph, an updated graph from NOAA showing how the actual sunspots compare to the predictions. And since 20, when we were in the last minimum, the ramp up to maximum, where, you know, each month the sun, number of sunspots increases on the surface of the sun, it's been going up much faster than the prediction, much faster. And there were hints that maybe over the last 4 or 5 months that maybe it's hit its peak and it's now going to be a flat maximum for the rest of the, you know, not go up much higher, which would put it pretty close to the prediction, even though it arrived at the high numbers much sooner. And I'm talking about like two years sooner, maybe three. This last month in June throws that out the window completely. In June, the sun was more active than it has been since September in 2002, and that was as the solar maximum was ending around 2000. That's two maximums past. It skips past the last maximum. This is more active than the whole entire week maximum that we had in 14. They never got to these numbers in 14. So the consensus opinion, consensus doesn't work in science. You can come up with a consensus, but it doesn't, if only one person has a different opinion and that turns out to be right, that's the opinion that counts. And in this case, there was a small group of dissenting solar scientists who predicted in 2020 that this upcoming maximum was going to be very active. And so they seemed to have hit the number, but they themselves chickened out a few 2 months ago and revised their prediction downward. And now they might actually have sort of stuck with their original prediction. We don't know, though, what will happen. And this, all the fact that all these predictions turn out to be unreliable, just is another illustration of how little we know about the sun. We know sunspots come from the magnetic field, activity of the magnetic field. We know they're related to the sun's dynamo that flips every 11 years in polarity. Why? We don't really understand. Why the cycle? We don't understand. How it fits together? We don't really understand. The fundamentals are not understood. All the predictions are based on past activity, trying to extrapolate into the future. And, you know, past performance does not predict the future. And so it's the case here. Now, that the sun is getting more active will suggest that the climate on Earth will get warmer. The point I always like to make is that this is important information because the sun is the number one factor in our climate. No, nothing else even comes close to comparing. And so understanding how the sun fits into our climate is really crucial. The trouble is that the obsession with human-caused global warming means that they're going to not look at this as well as they should, and they should be. Any warming that's seen in the next 5 years could be coming from the sun and not SUVs, and we should be looking at that very closely.
We go to the surface of Mars. This is a complicated story. It involves no tragedy. Perseverance is fine, ingenuity is fine, but we now suddenly are dealing with 63 missing days. Is that correct, Bob? 63?
Yes. 63 days of silence. In late April, the Ingenuity team posted their flight plan for the 52nd flight of Ingenuity and said on April 25th that the flight was scheduled for April 26th. And then usually about two or three days later, they post the results and give some information. Silence. For the next 2 months, nothing. And I was following this, and I kept saying, why are they not telling us anything? The only update they told us, they posted, was in late May, and that had nothing to do with the 52nd flight. It talked about how on an earlier flight in 49, they had some communications issues, and they weren't sure, and everything went fine. But they didn't talk anything about the 52nd flight in April. Nothing. Until this past weekend, they finally revealed that the 2 months of silence were because when Ingenuity landed on April 26th, it dropped down on the surface of Mars at a position where it no longer had line-of-sight communication with Perseverance. So without that communication, there was no way to relay the data of what had happened on the flight. Why they didn't say this to us, I don't know, but maybe they just were nervous and didn't want to tell everybody that they had no contact and did not know how the flight went. But so this had to sit there and wait until the Perseverance team finished what it was doing, because it was doing some core drilling and other investigations, until Perseverance could move into a position to regain line-of-sight communications. And that finally occurred this past week, and they were able to get download the data from Ingenuity. Its flight on the 26th was normal. It did land as planned in the spot it was supposed to. And more or less, we don't have the specific details yet of that flight. In fact, only in the next day or so after were pictures finally beginning to appear from that flight. They're not particularly exciting pictures because they only look at the ground. But nonetheless, Ingenuity is fine. I do not understand why they kept radio silence here. They should have told everybody exactly what the situation is. It's a great story. We're sitting here waiting, and the tension would have been building. It would have been a good public relations move. But instead, they kept quiet, and so that's where we are. Just.
And Ingenuity is nominal, and Perseverance is nominal, and they will continue. Now, Bob, some time ago, I recall the story was that Ingenuity was no longer going to be the scout. It was going to go in its direction. Perseverance was going to go in its direction. Do I remember that correctly?
No, this whole story today indicates it. Ingenuity has got to stay in line-of-sight communications with Perseverance. They have been basically testing the use of Ingenuity for the last, I don't know, 6 to 8 months. As a scout vehicle, it flies approximately over the ground that Perseverance is going to go and gets pictures, and that gives the Perseverance team a little extra data for planning the route for the rover. Now, Perseverance is not going to particularly rough ground, and it has good wheels, so it doesn't really need this extra information. But they're testing how to do this for future rover helicopter missions. That, you know, this is going to be a game that's going to be played down the road. So that's what they're doing. It's still an engineering test, but they're testing the engineering of how a scout would function, and it's so far pretty successful.
And the helicopter concept is now uniformly rewarded. They understand that the next probes must have helicopters to be successful. Is that correct?
I wouldn't put it that way. What I would say is that there is a lot of excitement with the idea of using helicopters on future planetary missions, and scientists are there's very clear indications that a lot of scientists who want to propose missions for Mars are including or focusing on using helicopters as their goal. I've posted on Behind the Black. There's at least one scientist who has used Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter to put together images in Valles Marineris, where he apparently wants to propose a helicopter mission into the Great Canyon. And they're talking about using helicopters in the sample return mission to pick up these core samples from Perseverance. So what we're going to see is a move by the scientists themselves to push for helicopter missions, and I think, of course, they'll get them because they have it has advantages. There's no doubt about that.
Our solar system is in a happy arm of the Milky Way, and we presume there's nothing bad happening around us that would challenge our ability to exist. Bob, however, has a story that would have been intimidating if we got this story before it happened. A supernova in our near our solar system. Bob, is there evidence that cosmic rays could damage us severely?
Yes, cosmic rays are one of the health problems that astronauts have when they're on a space station for long periods of time. But in an interplanetary flight, it's going to be a problem. And now, cosmic rays are a general thing that occur throughout the universe. They usually come from supernova. But the story here has to do with increasing evidence. This is not a new theory. There's been evidence in asteroids and meteorites now for decades that suggest a supernova had occurred very close to our solar system during its early formative periods. They find these things called chondrules within meteorites, and they're literally, they look like a little circular sphere. And what they think is that there was some melting, and you get basically a blob of melted material, and then the meteorite forms around it, and droplets essentially form from the supernova. Well, there's more evidence now coming from astronomers looking at what they call short-lived radionucleotides. This is a variation of isotopes, and they look at them, and they are getting further data that suggests a supernova occurred close to our solar system in its formative period. Didn't destroy the solar system, but it inserted these isotopes into our solar system in greater numbers than you normally would expect. What's the positive or negative? It's totally unknown. We don't know enough information. It could be very much one of the reasons we have life here. It could be, might not. It might have nothing to do with that. But this is one of those interesting details that suggests though solar system cells are not unique, our solar system might in itself be unique in these strange ways, John.
And we go to another story about galaxies. This story is the unusual evidence that James Webb Space Telescope is giving us about the Big Bang and the early part of our existence, the existence of everything. As I recall the story, Bob, there's evidence of galaxies sophisticated in some fashion forming too early for the previous theory. Is that still standing as a question mark?
Yes, I link on Behind the Black to a column in Nature, which listed six different galaxies that Webb has found that are of most bafflement. These are all less than 650 million years after the Big Bang. Some are much closer to the Big Bang than that. Some are heavier than expected, some are more active than expected, some are larger than expected, some are more complex than expected. None on their own disprove the Big Bang. All, however, raise serious questions about the theories that posit that event and the subsequent evolution of the planet. Of the universe, not the planet, the universe. And the astronomers, the cosmologists, and the observers are really having a lot of fun with this because it really raises great questions about what we've thought the universe was going to be. And I repeat, it doesn't disprove yet the Big Bang, but it's raising questions that are going to have to be solved to come up with a cosmology of the universe's birth that works. And right now, it doesn't look like any of the theories they've had about how the cosmos formed are correct and are going to have to be fixed.
We go to something closer at hand, lightning being studied and the early data from the instrument giving us. What did we not know about lightning, Bob?
And the idea here is, so first, we've learned since the beginning of the space age that lightning occurs really only over land. It doesn't occur over oceans when it's in storms. This is there's a lot of reasons why. I'm not going to get into that. But the theory, the thinking was from this European weather satellite is if we can put an instrument in geosynchronous orbit to study the ground and track lightning itself, it will help track thunderstorms for weather prediction. And so this instrument has finally released its first data, and I have a picture on Behind the Black, but most of it is actually movies they assembled from the data, which shows lightning over Europe, Africa, and some parts of Central America, because that's where this particular geosynchronous satellite is located. And so what you see is you can see thunderstorms as they track across the ground. And it's really interesting because when the storm goes across from land to ocean, like it hits the Mediterranean, for example, the sparks of lightning disappear. They go away. It doesn't have lightning anymore over water. But what it does is it tells you on land where these are. And so it's weather prediction, basically. They can use this to get a better idea of where thunderstorms are and predict them for the ground.
And we go to Parker, which is a probe, but we need to restate it. It's been some time. What is Parker's mission, Bob?
The Parker Solar Probe, it's been orbiting the sun, and each orbit it gets closer and closer to the sun, and it's designed to go through the sun's atmosphere, its corona, and get in as close as possible to provide data of that corona that we've never had before. And every orbit, it adjusts its position so that it comes in closer and travels faster, and it includes in these orbits zipping past Venus to help it drop in closer. And so on June 22nd, it completed its 16th close approach to the sun. I mean, it's really close. They really have to protect this. It was only 5.3 million miles above the solar surface. This is really close. This is an area where if a comet shows up, it gets destroyed, basically. And when it passed by, it was going 364,000 miles per hour. This is probably the fastest thing any human spacecraft has ever traveled. And it's now completed that. It's getting ready for its next flyby of Venus, the 6th, and it continues to operate well and gather data about the corona and how the sun's inner atmosphere functions, John.
Bob Zimmerman, Behind the Black. There's an update from SpaceX. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.